You're listening to episode 122 of Flick Fights, the official podcast of FlickChart.com. Hello, Flick Charters, and welcome to Flick Fights, the official Flick Chart podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Chase.
And I'm Lou Secchi.
And we're here to examine the best films of all time through a series of movie matchups head-to-head. And as we decide the victors between each pair, our chart grows and refines to reflect all of our collective taste in movies. If you're not already on Flick Chart, head over to flickchart.com, sign up for your free account, and rank all the movies that we'll be talking about on an account of your very own. We're without Eric this week because he has bronchitis and a sore throat, and so he's got to take some time to recuperate on his throat. But on this episode, we are going to be adding the sprawling Wachowski Tom Tyker epic Cloud Atlas. And we also have special guest Jandy Hardesty from Los Angeles, California, who goes by FaithX5 on Flickchart. She's actually joining us from Pensacola on her vacation, so we're appreciative of her taking a little time out of her vacation to do the show with us.
Yeah.
In addition to being a member of our blogging staff at Flickchart, Jandy has just under 100,000 rankings and 3,703 movies ranked on her chart to date. Jandy's current top five are In a Lonely Place, The Young Girls of Rochefort, Singing in the Rain, The 400 Blows, and at number one, Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. So, Jandy, obviously, you are a big lover of classic film, and in addition to running our monthly rundown of TCM's movie schedule on the blog, where do you think that love of classic film originated? Was it your parents introducing you to old movies? Was it something that you gravitated towards in school? Or where did that interest originate?
Well, I can tell you 100% it was my mom.
Okay.
She grew up in the 40s and, you know, going to the movies every weekend with her friends, 35 cents a pop, including if you wanted popcorn. And she just had a love for that era's music, movies specifically, and musicals. And so when I started watching movies, that's what she showed me. And so I grew up on particularly musicals, but also dramas and comedies and other stuff from the 1940s and 50s. And I liked them enough that by the time I was a teenager and starting to pick my own movies, I branched out from there myself into silent films and 60s movies and foreign films, and went on from there.
Interesting. So you're almost kind of just your first exposure to film was from that era. So you kind of that became your sort of home base for movies rather than just the movies that were coming out, you know, in modern cinema.
It is for sure. The way that a lot of my age peer group, like you guys, the way you guys feel about 80s movies is how I feel about 40s and 50s movies. They are my childhood nostalgia movies.
Right. Awesome. Well, cool. Well, we'd like to get into the discussions right away on Flick Fights, so we'll chat more with Jandy after we emerge from the Thunderdome.
Two men, hand to hand. No jury, no appeal, no parole. Two men enter, one man leaves.
Weapons?
Anything is possible. Chance decides.
Thunderdome. How do I get in there?
That's easy. Pick a fight.
All right, first up, we've got Walk the Line against Aaron Brockovich. So Walk the Line is a biopic about Johnny Cash and his life, and then Aaron Brockovich is, of course, about Aaron Brockovich, Julia Roberts in the title role. So which of these stories is the better film, though?
Yeah, it's a good question. They're both really, well-acted movies. I thought, I haven't seen Aaron Brockovich in a long time. I think I only saw it once in the theater. But I came out of that with a new appreciation for that story. And it, you know, Julie Roberts, I thought, did a great job in the role as Erin Brockovich.
Mm-hmm.
Walk the line, though. I mean, I don't know. I just thought the performance of Joaquin Phoenix was amazing as Johnny Cash. You know, I mean, I don't, not that I'm a big country fan, but, you know, I've listened to him. My parents are country fans back in the day, and Johnny Cash, that was the kind of music they listened to. And so I've seen him perform. I've seen him, you know, listen to him and stuff. And he did a really good job with that role, I thought. I'm not sure if, you know, because it's newer in my mind. I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it probably on video maybe 4 or 5 years ago. You know, it's more fresh in my mind, so it sticks there. Maybe it's getting a little ahead of Erin Brockovich because of that, but...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you guys think?
I'm a huge fan of Erin Brockovich. I think it's Julie Roberts' best role that she's ever done.
Well, I'll agree with that.
Yeah.
For sure. It's not a super high bar.
I was going to say, yeah, there's not a lot of stuff that she's done that's been like, oh my God, that was amazing.
Right.
I was just going to say, whereas Joaquin Phoenix is like always great. It's not, I mean, we were talking about how Julia Roberts is unusually good in Erin Brockovich, and Joaquin Phoenix is always good, so.
Yeah, I think the scripts are pretty strong on both of these, and they both feature a strong lead. I mean, I've seen some critiques of Walk the Line saying that it's too cliche or that it's too, like... what you would expect of a biopic. It's like every checkbox has kind of like been checked as you go through the film. It's like it's too sensationalized or something. Like it's not real enough. But I don't know. I liked both movies, but I think for me, I think Erin Brockovich is probably the stronger story, the stronger performance.
I think Erin Brockovich will be remembered longer. I think the film had an impact. It was a, you know, it made a statement for what was going on back in the day, about people's, you know, awareness of the, you know, dumping, illegal dumping,
mm-hmm.
More to a forefront. I think it had maybe a little more of a social, you know, lead because of that. So it'll probably be the longer lasting film as far as, you know, memory goes. I guess I could go Erin Brockovich as well.
Well, I like music more than I like social messages, so I don't
walk away. All right.
Also, I like Reese Witherspoon in it, and she kind of always doesn't always get the greater parts, and I thought she was really good as June Carter in this.
Yeah, she's pretty good. She definitely
has it over the edge, I guess, for me.
Sure. All right, well, we'll go with Erin Brockovich over Walk the Line. Okay, next up we've got Scary Movie against The Sound of Music.
This is a really bizarre matchup.
Really bizarre matchup.
And this is why Flick Chart is awesome, right here.
Yeah, yeah. It's two movies you would never think about next to each other, for sure. So Scary Movie is a satire, a parody movie of the Scream franchise and a bunch of other horror films around the year 2000. And Sound of Music is, of course, the Rodgers and Hammerstein, Julie Andrews musical that everybody knows and loves. So can anybody make a good argument that Scary Movie is a better film than Sound of Music?
No. I mean, not in terms of a better movie. I mean, I didn't like Sound of Music, but I mean, I respect it as a film.
Really?
I'm not a big musical fan, but... it's funny, but my biggest memory of Sound of Music is just the controversy over when, I guess it was ABC, played it for, it was on a Sunday football game. It was like double overtime for, I want to say it was the Raiders, and they cut to Sound of Music with like 2 minutes left.
Oh, wow. There's
no way the team was going to come back. They cut this, so all these football fans all over the country were just outraged that they have the Sound of Music coming on. And I guess the biggest controversy was the Raiders came back, or the other team came back and actually changed the score and won. But
oh my gosh,
I just remember that controversy over it. But yeah, I mean, Scary Movie is a fun movie. I really enjoyed it. It was the first one of the bunch, which it makes it better to me than the ones that came after that. But yeah, it's not as good of a piece of film as the Sound of Music.
It's no Airplane.
Well, yeah, that too.
I can't actually make a case for the existence of Scary Movie. So,
oh, well, that hurts.
I mean, Scream is already a parody of those horror movie tropes. So, like, why do we need a parody of the parody?
Well,
that's what
yeah.
I don't understand.
I've heard that argument before, yeah.
All right.
So yeah, I would vote Sound of Music.
Yeah, I don't think it's a hard choice here. Sound of Music is going to beat Scary Movie. All right, next up we've got Knocked Up against American Pie 2. So these are both kind of raunchy teen-ish comedies. American Pie 2 certainly is nowhere near as beloved as the first film in the series. And then Knocked Up is Judd Apatow directing with Seth Rogen and Katherine Heigl and Paul Rudd. This is kind of like the last movie that Katherine Heigl got to do because she kind of became universally known in Hollywood as a someone who can't, basically nobody wants to work with her because of her attitude and her... I don't really know which this is more which yeah. one is not as bad as
exactly
instead I of mean, which is better.
Yeah, the whole Knocked Up thing is kind of, I don't know, it's the same movie that we've seen three or four of the times with the same characters almost. Not exactly, but it feels the same. The comedy's the same, the actors are mainly the same. It was funny the first couple of times, but it just gets, I need something different, you know. But American Pie 2 was just not very good. I mean, the first American Pie was interesting. It was a good, funny movie. But the sequel just didn't do anything for me.
Well, I hate Knocked Up.
Okay.
It's one of the very few movies that I actively dislike. So, sounds like that's not a completely unpopular opinion on this podcast, like I expected it to be.
No, yeah, I'm with you. I'm not a fan of it, so...
I don't mind the American Pie movies for some reason, except American Wedding was terrible, but the first two I don't mind. So I'll go with a light vote on American Pie 2, but yeah, I
yeah.
just like Knocked Up.
Yeah, I thought Knocked Up was kind of just, it made you feel bad watching it. Like it actively has a sort of negative tone and I don't know, it's very odd. The way the characters are portrayed and the whole presentation is just really kind of off-putting for some reason. I don't really remember much about American Pie 2. It's kind of like just all rehash of the first movie where they're kind of getting back together after they've gotten to college or something like that. It's like there's no real...
It's the first year after college.
There's no story to it whatsoever. It's just...
No. I mean, the first one has a story. And it was funny. You know, it had some shocking moments. The second one was okay. I mean, I didn't leave the theater going, why did I spend money on that? But
yeah.
Yeah, Knocked Up didn't do anything for me at all. So I'll definitely go with you guys on American Pie 2.
All right. American Pie 2 will beat Knocked Up. Next up, we've got Underworld against American History X. So this is Kate Beckinsale doing her best vampire cosplay. And this is Edward Norton doing his best neo-Nazi cosplay. Very dark movies, both of these, I guess. Underworld is sort of a action fantasy, but it's also still seeped in that sort of gothic texture and aesthetic. Mm-hmm. But American History X is dark in a different way, dark in a seriously,
sort of
yeah.
commentary sort of way, yeah.
Yeah, seriously racial divide and, yeah, just socially awkward and dark movie. American History X is one of those movies where it's hard to say that you like it because of its subject matter. It's so intense and so kind of defeating that you would never say, oh, yeah, I love American History X. It's one of my favorites. But,
you know, it's kind of funny. I will say that. I mean, I really did like American History X. I thought it was a very powerful movie. I mean, I don't like it for the message and the content. But,
right.
I mean, I thought it was, you know, it was probably a good... you know, third of the way into the movie where I really realized it was, you know, Ed Norton. I'm like, oh my God. Cause I didn't know much about the movie when I saw it. And, I was like, oh my God, Ed Norton didn't even realize that for a while. I mean, the the archetypes in the movie was very powerful. The scene, the imagery, the way it was shot. I thought everything about that was great. And the message at the end was pretty good. You know, the whole redemption kind of thing and the struggle within his character. And then his brother? Mm-hmm. Was it Furlong's character's brother? Yeah. I just thought it was a really, really, really powerful movie. It's in my top 50.
Yeah, it's the only other movie other than Terminator 2 that I can think of that stars Eddie Furlong.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen another one, but I can't think of what it is either. I'd have to look it up. Yeah, I definitely agree. American History X is a great movie, but it's, as I've been going through and re-ranking my chart by title in order, and it keeps moving down because I'm ranking more based on, like, emotional attachment, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so it's, I don't know, this is kind of a tough matchup, weirdly, for me, because American History X is clearly the better movie, but I have a lot of love for weird gothic fantasy girls with guns movies. So I'm pretty sure American History X is still higher on my flick chart at this point, but that may just be because I haven't gotten to Underworld yet in my re-rank. I don't know. But I think in this context, I would vote American History X.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I'll agree with what Lou was saying in the sense that it's powerful. The performances are really strong. It's well shot. It's a well-made film from top to bottom. And
you know, when there's scenes in movies that can make you physically cringe, you know, it's a movie. Sure. It's like, oh wow, you know, it's like that really raises the hair in the back of your neck and makes you feel like you're part of the movie.
The curb stomp is what comes to mind.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah. It's the moment you can't get out of your mind. Okay, so Underworld is going to be beat by American History X. Okay, next up we've got Mission Impossible 3 from 2006 up against National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. So Mission Impossible 3 is the J.J. Abrams-directed Mission Impossible film. It's got Philip Seymour Hoffman in the antagonist role. And, of course, Christmas Vacation is the Christmas-themed Chevy Chase vacation film, famously also with Randy Quaid doing his... I think he's the cousin or the uncle or something like that.
Cousin Eddie, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, Cousin Eddie. So we've got an action versus a comedy. I don't know. I'm not as hot on Mission Impossible 3 as a lot of other people are. So a lot of people seem to think it's the best of the entire franchise, but for me, it really fell flat, and I don't know exactly why. Like, I'm usually a J.J. Abrams fan. I like most of the stuff he's done, but for some reason, that film just doesn't fit at all into the sort of aesthetic of the rest of the franchise for me. It seems like it's a movie that's not really a Mission Impossible movie.
See, for me, the whole Mission Impossible franchise is kind of a blur. There's no real... None of them stood out to me to the point where I can... Oh, yeah, two was this one, one was this one, three... Mm-hmm. You know, one I remember, but the other ones are all kind of like just... it's part of the story, you know? So I tend to not...
Two is the John Woo one.
Well,
yeah.
Two is John Woo, okay.
Yeah. Doves and motorcycles.
Doves,
that's what I remember.
Doves flying around. Lots of the face-switching thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was that one. Okay, yeah, where everybody had the mask 18 times. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, for that fact, since it doesn't stand out as a separate film to me, I have a hard time ranking it over other stuff.
Right.
National Lampoon's Vacation, on the other hand, was a very funny Christmas movie. A very funny movie in itself. But, I mean, so many quotable lines in that one. Maybe not as much as the first one, but still a very good movie. Julie Louis Dreyfus's role as the neighbor that were all kind of uppity and didn't get
his
love of Christmas and stuff, and the whole you know, decorating the entire house with lights that wouldn't work, and I mean, everything kind of just rang true to, you know, Christmas mishaps that we've all heard about over the years. And I mean, Chevy Chase is just amazing as a comedic actor. So yeah, I've got to lean towards that one.
Yeah, I'm leaning that way too. What do you say, Jandy?
Well, we all know comedy is pretty subjective, and this is not my style of comedy. I saw it a lot of times when I worked in a video store in the 90s, and the main thing I remember different parts of the movie, but the main thing I remember is that we had to, there's one section where he gets like a tape that has some nudity on it. And my store manager would always have to like crinkle the VHS tape because this was in the 90s and we still had VHS. He had to crinkle the VHS tape so that that wasn't visible because so that we could show it in the store.
That's funny.
That's crazy.
So
that's
more memories about the way that I saw it than the movie itself. But
that will affect it.
I like Mission Impossible 3 a lot, and I like the whole series. Like, I was thinking about the other day that I even like 2, which is usually the most maligned of the whole series.
Yeah.
Of all the kind of long-running franchises, I feel like every entry in that one is pretty solid. So I'm going to take Mission Impossible 3, but I think I'm going to get outvoted, and that's fine.
Yeah, there's just something about, like, it just doesn't feel as fun as the other ones.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, but Philip Seymour.
Yeah.
Like, how can you vote against Philip Seymour Hoffman ever?
But yeah, I would be with you. Like, he's almost always the best thing in the movie when he's in it, right? So,
true.
For some reason, in 3, like, he's menacing. Like, you know, he does have that air of, like, this is a bad guy. But he never really gets to do much. And there's sort of, like, a MacGuffin throughout the movie that where they're just always trying to get this thing. I can't even remember what it is. But it's, like, it's totally inconsequential. It's just the thing that makes everybody move around in the plot. And it's, I don't know.
And for me, I think the problem with Mission Impossible to me is that, I mean, I grew up watching the TV series, you know, back in the day. So that to me is like that's the original. And it almost feels like Tom Cruise overshadows what Mission Impossible is. And I'm not a Tom Cruise hater. I mean, I like him in a lot of roles, but I get the impression that he thinks he's bigger than the role in this case. And it's just, I don't know, it just doesn't feel good to me, I guess. So I guess it's more about the actor than it is about the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked Ghost Protocol, which is the 4th one. And then the newest one was okay. It wasn't quite as good. So
I actually haven't seen that one yet. So I guess I need to see that one before I make sweeping statements about the whole series.
Yeah, right. Okay, for now, we will go with Christmas Vacation over Mission Impossible 3. All right, next up we have Juno up against Garden State. So these are both sort of indie darlings. Juno was the first movie by Reitman's son. I can't think of his first name for the life of me, but Jason Reitman. Yes, thank you. And Diablo Cody was the writer who kind of became famous very quickly because of her writing on Juno. And then Garden State was Zach Braff and Natalie Portman. The Garden State has kind of become sort of the poster movie for hipster, like indie hipster movie. And at the time, I don't think it really had that air or that quality to it. But over time, for some reason, it's sort of been stamped in a negative light for that reason.
Both of these films were kind of really popular for a little bit, and then they both kind of experienced a backlash in the later years. Mm. Maybe Garden State more so, but I think Juno has also had some amount of "this is way too cute" backlash.
Right. Yeah, it's like they were, you know, they're both trying to be very earnest, very kind of not realistic, but sort of just painting a picture of what it's like to be a young person in the mid-2000s. And it's, you know, maybe it's just that they were trying too hard to make the emotional beats happen or something. And it's become sort of cliche over time now, or I don't know. I mean, I remember really enjoying both of the films when I watched them. I haven't seen them since they came out, essentially. I don't think I saw either one in the theater, but I know I saw both of them probably on DVD or VHS. So I don't know. Which one is the better movie, though, of these two?
I like both these when they came out, and I still have them both not super high on my chart, but within my top 1,000 easily, probably 500. So I still like them both. I think I would... it's kind of... It is hard. Because they're actually kind... I mean, they're not similar in story, but they're kind of similar in... They both feel kind of twee and kind of... that. Yeah, I can see the hipster... argument. I think I would give it to Garden State, even if it's purely by virtue of the soundtrack, which I think is... I mean, it's that kind of indie pop stuff that was popular in the early 2000s, but it led me to a lot of bands that I hadn't heard before, and kind of, I don't know, I would say it was kind of the beginning of my interest in indie rock, which lasted me at least through 2012 or so, and then I've kind of fallen off the bandwagon now, but I was really into it for a while, and Garden State was part of that, so I have a lot of fond memories of it for the music alone.
Yeah, there's that scene where Natalie Portman's listening to The Shins, and she's like, this band will change your life kind of thing. And it's, I'm sure that that probably sold a million albums for The Shins.
Probably. I never saw Juno, so I can't really, you know, vote on both these. But I mean, I saw Garden State. It was okay. It wasn't the worst thing I've ever seen, but I wasn't really into it, I guess, at the time. Maybe I was a little too old when it came out and... past the hipster part of my life, so maybe, you know, that was a...
Right. Yeah, I remember it felt kind of like... It's right in the same vein as Napoleon Dynamite a little bit, but maybe not quite as, like,
it's
kooky.
It's not as goofy as Napoleon
Dynamite. Yeah, not as goofy, but sort of still that same, like, a bunch of young people kind of just... aloof in life or something, you know, like not really taking life quite so seriously yet or something. I tend to think that Juno was a pretty strong film from my memory. J.K. Simmons was in it, I believe.
Oh, yeah, as
the father. Yeah, and he's good. Michael Cera.
Allison Janney's in it too as the mom, and she's great. It's kind of a film where the supporting actors almost take over a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. There's lots of good characters. I mean, there's good characters in both, but yeah, I don't know. I'd probably have to look at my own chart to see. I'm not really exactly sure which one would be higher for me. I don't even know what the globals would say for this, to be honest.
I have a feeling Juno is going to rank higher.
Yeah, because I think Garden State has had more of a backlash against it.
Probably. It's probably right. Well, let's see. Juno is 515 on my chart. And it is 749 globally. And Garden State is... 622 on my chart and 1,035 globally. So yeah, it looks like Juno, both for me and for the world at large, is the better film between these two. So I guess I guess that's true.
My vote sticks with Garden State, 180 versus 707 right now. So quite a bit. Actually.
Okay.
Juno has fallen tremendously in my re-rank apparently.
Yeah. All right, Juno.
It needs to be much higher.
Yeah. Juno will beat Garden State. Next up, we've got The Departed against V for Vendetta. The Departed is Martin Scorsese's Boston modern mobster movie with Leo DiCaprio and Matt Damon and Mark Wahlberg and Jack Nicholson. And V for Vendetta is Natalie Portman and Hugo Weaving. And the Wachowskis produced it, but somebody else directed it. I can't remember who directed it off the top of my head. But also based off of Alan Moore comic. I think that's right. Is that right, Lou?
I don't know who wrote the comic.
Okay.
Unfortunately, sorry. Yeah.
I think that's right.
Same guy that wrote Alan Moore. Yeah, same guy that wrote Watchmen.
Yeah, exactly. Which of these is the better film?
Oh, good question. this one kind of has a two-part answer for me. I mean, if which one I'd rather watch again, or which one's a better movie? you know, I tend to lean toward V for Vendetta as wanting to watch it again. I enjoyed the movie. I thought the I'd never read the comics, so to me it was a new story. It wasn't like I was trying to compare it to the comics that were out already. But I really enjoyed the imagery. I liked the storyline. I thought it was kind of inventive. The Departed, I thought, was very well acted, though. I thought DiCaprio did a great job. It's kind of where I first started to give DiCaprio more credit for doing better roles. you know, I mean, I think he had a bad rap in his early career of being a pretty boy, and it was really all he had going for him. But I think he's proved himself as a much better actor, and this is one of the roles that kind of led me to say, yeah, he is a better actor than I think a lot of people give him credit for.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's come back to that whole which one's a better movie, which one do I want to watch. I think V for Vendetta is a more fun movie to watch, but the better piece of film is probably Departed.
Yeah, V for Vendetta, the thing about that film, I think, is more the sort of monologues and the clever wordplay of V. Mm. And is sort of infamous because of Natalie Portman shaving her head for the role. But I think overall the movie is not that strong in terms of plot, and in terms of there's not a lot of characters in the film. So therefore it's a much smaller story to be told. Whereas The Departed feels like a lot larger, a lot more epic. The scope of it is bigger. The stakes are higher. The emotion and acting on display is much more heightened and sort of intense, I think. And everybody in The Departed is good. Pretty much, like, there are no bad actors in that film. So I'd say I probably would go with Departed as the better film.
I think V for Vendetta is really stylish, and there's a lot of visuals in that movie that I thought were just incredible. So I really enjoyed watching it, but it's been a while since I've seen it, so I don't remember all the details, but I remember being fairly troubled by what the underlying message seemed to be in terms of anarchy and vigilantism and those kind of things.
Right.
So I remember being like, this is beautiful, and I disagree with everything it's saying. But I'm sure, I mean, a lot of that is from the comic, but still. I don't know, I agree, I would probably rewatch V for Vendetta first, just for the visuals and to, you know, get it in my head better what it was that made me uncomfortable about it. But I think I would definitely vote The Departed as the better and more long-lasting movie. What's going to be remembered longer?
I have still yet to see Infernal Affairs, which is the movie that The Departed was a remake of. But I'm curious, though, because if The Departed is as good as it is, I'm really curious to see if the original is also as good. Just because it's basically the same story, but told, you know, in a completely different setting, and, you know, completely different cast. So I just wonder how well it works in comparison. Okay, so it sounds like The Departed is going to beat V for Vendetta. All right, next up we've got High Fidelity against Cruel Intentions. High Fidelity is John Cusack, based off of a Nick Hornby novel, I think. And then Cruel Intentions is Sarah Michelle Gellar, Ryan Philippe, and Reese Witherspoon. And Selma Blair, I believe, is in it too.
Yep.
And these are both really good movies. Yeah.
Yep.
High Fidelity in particular stands out to me because of the constant creation of top five lists that John Cusack and some of the other characters do. It makes me think of how a lot of flick charters think in terms of creating their top fives of stuff in various different permutations. It's also, I think, a really creative, unusually told romance that's, you know, for a romantic comedy that basically goes completely opposite of how you would expect a romantic comedy to go. It's High Fidelity is one of them. But now Cruel Intentions, too, it's also a movie that really is kind of unique. The characters are not black and white. They're all very gray. The motivations behind everybody are very, you have no idea where anybody sits throughout the movie. It's sort of like a mystery thriller wrapped up in a teen romance movie, but with this weird sort of dark comedy overtone to it. It's just very unusual, very cool, very creative. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you guys think? Which of these is your favorite?
Well, I like High Fidelity, but I love Cruel Intentions.
Yeah.
It is, I don't know, some people would consider it a guilty pleasure movie, but I mean, it's based on Dangerous Liaisons, which is a classic French novel, and several mm-hmm. movies have been based on it, and it's just kind of taking that into the teen realm, and somehow this story of all of these infidelities and, you know, aristocratic type people having affairs and all kinds of stuff just becomes super trashy, but also really, really fun and compelling in the high school world, because these kids are not acting like high schoolers, right?
Right. Right.
And I think that level of kind of melodrama on top of the high school. Well, I mean, it's not your typical high school either, right? It's like your prep school, high school. Is just really fun. And yeah, you're right. Different. It is dark, but it. I don't know. I love Cruel Intentions.
Yeah.
You know, I thought I was going to be in a minority here, and you said some words there that I was thinking in my head before we actually started talking about this, of being a guilty pleasure movie for me. And I'm like, oh, God, I'm going to have to come out and say I like this movie a lot. But no, you're right. It's a very smart movie for what it is. And, you know, set in a teen world just has that, I don't know, it just doesn't feel right, but it is. You know, it's like, you know, you shouldn't have this kind of a story going on with teenagers, but it does a great job of it. And the acting was superb. And I think everybody in the movie did a really good job with their roles.
Well, and this was at a time in 1999 that was not too long after Buffy started, only a couple years. So this was a complete opposite for Sarah Michelle Gellar. And I think she's really good in it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you guys 100%. I like Cruel Intentions immensely.
So you're also going to take that over High Fidelity then, Lou?
Oh, yeah. And I'm a big John Cusack fan, but yeah, I've got to take Cruel Intentions over that.
Okay.
If yeah, it was Gross Point Blank versus this, it'd be a different story maybe, but I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big fan of both of these movies, but I'm a big, big fan of High Fidelity. It's 31 on my chart. So.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Cruel Intentions is like in the 300s, I think. It's still up there, but it's not quite as strong as High Fidelity. And I know that for a lot of people, High Fidelity is sort of a hit or miss. Like you either totally like feel like you're part of it, or you just don't get it at all. Like I have some real close friends that saw it and hated it. They thought it was terrible. And then like my wife and I, we saw it and we were just like, this is one of the best movies we've ever seen, kind of thing. So it seems like it's very polarizing. All right, so Cruel Intentions is going to beat High Fidelity.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an additional award tonight, fellow book fairies. An award for most eminent critic, Mr. Oh, beg pardon, Sir Felix Fitch. O, B, and E.
And what might my prize be, I wonder? A signed copy of an unpulped knuckle sandwich? Can't be many of those left. Well? Just what does that leadless pencil you call an imagination have in mind to end this scene?
I think you're gonna love this one. Now that's an ending that is flat and lame beyond belief.
All right, now it is time for our title fight. And we are going to be adding Cloud Atlas to the chart. So, what did you guys think of Cloud Atlas when you saw it? Did you see it in the theaters? Did it blow your mind? Was it an eye-opening experience watching that movie?
Yes, yes, and yes.
What about you, Lou?
Yeah, I saw it in the theater. It was eye-opening, yeah, maybe. But it wasn't mind-blowing. I was kind of, I don't know, I read the book first. And the book left me a little perplexed. Like, well, maybe the movie will clear some stuff up, and the movie didn't.
Yeah,
I mean, I can appreciate the imagery and the way it was shot, but I just didn't get the story. You know what I mean? It just didn't. It didn't feel very fulfilling to me.
It's a very esoteric story. There's no way of getting around that. But it is also very beautiful and incredibly well shot and well thought out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a pretty big fan of Cloud Atlas.
Oh, yeah, so. Okay. I mean, I appreciate the movie. I'm just not a huge fan of it.
So. Sure.
It is currently the newest movie in my top 100. It's in the 80s somewhere. And
wow, really?
Yeah. How many
movies do you have on your list?
3,700.
Wow, it's in the top 100 of all those movies. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that and Scott Pilgrim are the only two 2010s films that are in my top 100.
Okay, Scott Pilgrim I can see. Yeah, okay.
So, have you also read the book, Jandy?
Yes, I read the book a few months before the film came out.
Okay, so you both had preconceptions of these characters before going to see the movie then?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. So do you think that the movie would have worked better or had been a different experience if you had watched the movie before reading the book? Like, for me, I've only seen the movie. I did not read the book. So I went into it completely cold, and I totally got it. Like, I get all of the connections. I get how everything is connected, the way that the characters interact with each other. I mean, that all makes sense to me. And I've read various things about the novel in the sense that the novel is very different from the movie in the way that it's structured. Like the movie, they had to like kind of split it up a lot. But in the book, it's more like it goes from chronologically from like the what from the future to the present and then from the present back to the future. Is that right?
Well, the book starts with the oldest one.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's the sailing ship.
Yeah.
And then it gives half of that one, and then it breaks, and then gives half of the next story chronologically. And then, like that, like half all the way up. And then it has all of the post-apocalyptic one, and then goes back in reverse order, giving the second half of each story.
Second half of each one, yeah. Now, I didn't read it as a physical book. I read it as an audiobook, so maybe that was a little bit more distracting, too, because it seemed very... I was like, wait, where am I now? What? Okay.
Which,
you know,
book, just, yeah, which one are you in?
Exactly. That might have been more clear in a physical book to read. But I mean, I don't know. I thought the book gave me some context to what the movie was going to be ahead of time. So maybe some things made a little bit more sense in the movie. But it was a very different piece of art versus the book.
Which did you like better?
I think I liked the book better.
Okay.
Even though it left me a little bit, you know, kind of curious, I did go back and reread it or re-listen to it again after I saw the movie, because I thought maybe that would help me kind of understand things a little better, and it did. So you know, the second reading of the book made it feel a little bit more complete, I guess, just because I knew where it was coming from at that point. You know, doing the whole first thing through of getting half a story and I'm in a whole new story. I'm like, wait, but what happened here now? Okay, you know, it got better the second time through.
One of the things I love most about Cloud Atlas is Hugh Grant and his incredible role that he has. Well, like the specific role that he has in the future, like mega future time, where he's the sort of like, what do you call it? Like a tyrant, primitive, like with the blue and the headdress and like all the crazy, like he just looks crazy. it's so cool. It's so unusual for him. Like he doesn't get to ever play a role like that. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go ahead and put it up against some movies on the chart and, see how it fares. So first up, it's up against Dodgeball.
Which I have not seen. So,
all right.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Don't screw pretty, this up, guys. Come on.
Pretty easy here for me.
Yeah. I'm not a huge Cloud Atlas fan, but it was definitely a better movie than Dodgeball. I mean, Dodgeball was a fun comedy. It was, you know, whatever, popcorn flick, but Cloud Atlas was definitely a much better film.
Yeah, it reaches a lot more heights. Cloud Atlas against Avatar.
Oh, that's interesting.
These have, like, the same poster almost.
It does,
Same colors. Yeah, same color palette.
Yeah, the blue and orange is always present.
Giant floaty faces.
Yep.
Some battle happening in the background.
Yep.
Cloud Atlas for me. I'm not a big Avatar fan.
I'm going to have to say Avatar. I know I've spoken against Avatar in the past on the show, but I think Avatar's overrated for what it is, but I think it beats Cloud Atlas here because it's just a more substantial story to me.
I don't know if that I would be able to say that Avatar has a more substantial story than Cloud Atlas. Cloud Atlas has a lot of story.
There's a lot going on, but it's not more original than Cloud Atlas, but it's, I don't know, I think it's more complete.
Cloud Atlas is from, like, the 1600s to, like, forever in the future. How is that?
Yeah.
Okay, when you see it that way.
Yeah. It's, this is kind of hard. Because I really did like Cloud Atlas a lot. But I'm also incredibly appreciative of the massive amount of talent on display with Avatar and the fact, like, the thing about Avatar that everybody forgets is that there's hardly any real sets in Avatar. Like, all of the forests and grass and mountains and water, it's all CG. All of it. And when you're watching
tech demo.
Oh, it is a
That's it's it.
The it's the best tech demo ever. And I just have so much like I have so much appreciation for it. Yeah. It's I put it on a pedestal because it's I think it's still to this day probably the best motion capture stuff that we've seen. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's from 2009, so it's getting up there now.
Yeah. And a lot of it doesn't look like it's CG. That's the thing that makes it nice.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know what's fantastical and it's not real, but it doesn't look so fake and in plastic that you're like, oh yeah, it's CG.
It's funny too, like the stuff in Cloud Atlas that I like the most is not the future stuff. It's not the Wachowski sort of like classic sci-fi stuff, and it's not the super future stuff. It's more the segment with the composer, like that whole sequence. That's the best of the story, and I think that's Tom Tykwer that did that one in particular. And then I liked the one with Hugo Weaving playing the nurse. It was kind of funny, but and then the one with Tom Cruise and sort of the real far past one was okay. It wasn't as good. And the one with Halle Berry, the sort of present day one, was just okay too. So yeah, it's like a mixed bag.
I like how you're saying that as if they aren't all in all of them.
Well, yeah, like I just think about them, you know, they have like this, they sort of have like starring roles in various time periods, right? So I don't know. I think I'll go with Lou. I think I'll go Avatar over Cloud Atlas. But it's close. I could be swayed probably with enough additional detail maybe, but for now, Avatar is going to be Cloud Atlas.
Can I convince you? Should I like keep talking or?
Yeah, I probably would have to rewatch Cloud Atlas and see if it like elevated it more in my mind.
Have you only seen it once?
Yeah, I've only seen it the once in the theater.
I was afraid that seeing it the second time would like ruin the magic of the first time, and especially seeing it like at home on a smaller screen where you weren't as overwhelmed with the everything happening.
Right.
But it didn't. I loved it just as much the second time. So I think when you watch it again, it won't be diminished.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I do definitely want to see it again sometime. All right. Let's see. Cloud Atlas up against Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, man. This for me is what that last one was for you.
Yeah. Yeah. These are both solid films.
I got to look where Pan's Labyrinth is on my chart.
I'm gonna go Cloud Atlas here because I was not a huge fan of Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I can appreciate the movie. I just didn't quite, you know, meld with the movie. So, Cloud Atlas was definitely a nicer movie in my opinion than Pan's Labyrinth. But it sounds like you guys both really like both movies, so it's gonna be interesting to hear what you guys say.
Yeah. I mean, I like Pan's Labyrinth okay. It's I think it's really stylish, and like all of Guillermo del Toro's movies are stylish. But you know, the monster design, the mood, the fact that you think it's going to be one kind of movie and it ends up being a complete reversal on it. It's sort of like From Dusk Till Dawn, where you think it's one genre and then like halfway through it becomes a different genre.
But Lou hasn't seen From Dusk Till Dawn, so.
Spoilers.
Sure, thanks, guys.
Well, I have to go with my chart, and Cloud Atlas, I just double checked, is 98, so it's still in the top 100, a little lower than I thought. And Pan's Labyrinth is 48.
So. Oh, wow.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, I love both of these. Like you were saying, Nathan, the way that. Not even so much the way that it kind of baits and switch what genre you think it's going to be, but the way that the dream world parallels the real world and the things that are going on with the Spanish Civil War at the time, that's just really, really impactful to me. One of my favorite tropes in stories is how stories help us deal with the real world. And so any film that's kind of about storytelling and that kind of trope is usually going to score well with me. And I think Pan's Labyrinth did that among the best films I've seen do that kind of story.
Have you seen Life is Beautiful?
I have. And that one doesn't rate quite as well with me.
Yeah. That's the one that comes to mind in terms of like using a story to cope with the real world kind of thing.
Yeah, it does, but that one feels a little cheaper to me. A little less appropriate.
Right.
Because that's about... It's more like he's trying to take the real world away from his son, rather than his son using stories to deal with it. I don't know. It's a distinction in my head.
Yeah. No, I get that. Yeah, I think I'm going to go with Lou, though. I think Cloud Atlas is the better movie. I think it reaches farther. I think it's more ambitious. I think it's better looking overall. Yeah. Interesting. So, sounds like Lou and I are going to be on the tipping factor on Cloud Atlas over Pan's Labyrinth.
Cloud Atlas is also kind of about storytelling, too.
Mm. You know, I think it's interesting when you get these kind of matchups and you really start looking at these movies in a different light. You know, like a movie like Clueless, I don't think is that great of a movie in my overall scheme of movies. But when you start putting up against movies and really analyzing for what they are, it'll certainly make you think about it differently.
We've got Cloud Atlas against The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Okay, I am not a big Tim Burton fan. And Nightmare Before Christmas is not one of my favorite movies at all. Which is funny because I love Halloween. I really wanted to like this movie, and I saw it, and I'm like, oh, I just don't like the imagery. I don't like the way it was done.
That's so weird to me. Like, have you only seen it once?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you should rewatch it sometime.
Really? You think so?
I bet you just were in a bad mood when you saw it because it's really, really good.
But the whole Tim Burton, you know, esque of a movie just doesn't sit well with me. The whole swirly thing he does everywhere in every movie he's ever done. it just bugs me. I don't know. It's just I know it's irrational, but
It's in my top 20. So
really, maybe I'll give it another shot because I really wanted to like it when it came out, and I'm like, oh, I walked in the movie thinking to myself, why did I come here? It's like, this is not fun at all. Maybe I'll give it another shot.
Well, Halloween is coming up. I like them. I like Nightmare Before Christmas pretty well, but not as much as Cloud Atlas. I love stop motion, so that gives anything that's stop motion a huge boost.
Right.
But it just doesn't affect me on an emotional, spiritual level as much.
Wow. Yeah, I the only thing about Nightmare that makes me upset is that it's been like co-opted by like the Hot Topic crowd, and like I wish that it hadn't, because I wish that it was just left alone. But
you wish it had fewer fans. I see.
Yeah,
you just don't like the fans, right? That's what it is.
I don't like that it's become sort of like a product rather than like it's not a movie anymore. It's more like a way of showing that you are a preteen goth kid. You know, like it's like middle school black eyeliner paraphernalia now. It's like, it's not really like, it's been the sort of brand of it has just been totally absorbed by culture in a way that irks me, but I still love it. It's top 20 for me. But okay, so you guys are both going Cloud Atlas, so Cloud Atlas beats Nightmare Before Christmas.
Have all three of us voted the same way yet?
No, I don't think so. Well, maybe the first one.
Maybe the first one, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, looks like Cloud Atlas is at 100 on our chart.
Okay. Out of how many? What are we
at? Out of 319. Okay. So, in the top third there. All right. That works. Well, let's ask Jandy a couple questions then before we wrap up the show. As we normally do, we like to ask everybody that comes on to the show how they originally came across Flickchart. And I think I know what your answer is going to be, but I'll let you tell it, Jandy.
Well, I don't remember.
Is that you what don't remember?
Gonna be? No.
Really?
No. I first came across it when it was in closed beta. Because I remember seeing it on some other website talked about, and I don't remember what other website it was, if it was like Film School Rejects or Slash Film or something like that. But they were talking about it, and I was like, hey, that sounds cool. I'll try that out. So I went in, and you had to request an invite at that time. So I requested an invite, and I think it was a while before I got one to where like I'd almost forgotten what it was. And then I got it, and I did it for a while, and I remember emailing you or contacting you a bunch of times. I didn't know you at that time.
Right.
Being like, why isn't this classic movie on the site? Or why isn't this one on
there? Right, right.
And then I quit using it for a while because so many of my favorite classics weren't on the site and you didn't have a submit form at that time. And then later, I was on FriendFeed and I met you there, Nathan.
Right.
And on FriendFeed, and at some point, we were just kind of chatting or whatever on different topics, and you mentioned that you were the founder of Flickchart, and I was like, what? I've used that site. And so then because of that, I kind of got back into it. And pretty soon after that, you added the submit form. And so I could fix all the database issues that films that weren't there. And I'm sure you and whoever else was approving films at the time just hated me because submitted a lot. But yeah, that was, I don't know. I mean, you know better than I when the closed beta was and so how long I've been on there.
I forgot that you had actually been a user of the site before we met on FriendFeed. So that's interesting. Yeah, so it was probably like early 2008 or something. So you've been on the site for a long time. Awesome. Okay. Next question would be, what film from your childhood did you really love that you're afraid doesn't really hold up if you were to rewatch it today?
I'm still not totally sure because most of the time when I do rewatch my favorites, I still like them. Even if I shouldn't. So I'm not too worried about them, but some that I haven't rewatched. Here's one that you, I don't know if you'll have heard of this one or not. It's actually from the 80s, but it's a Disney movie called The Journey of Natty Gann. Is that one that either of you are familiar with?
That name sounds familiar, I don't think I've seen it.
It seems like a lot of people haven't heard of it, even though, you know, we're the right generation to have seen it. It's about a girl who, like a teenage, maybe 14 or 15, and she's in a orphanage or something. Her dad is out west. It's like it's set in the gold rush kind of time period. And she one day just decides to leave this home where she lives and go out and find her dad. And so she's riding rails across the country. She's getting lifts with anyone she can, just kind of making her way by herself across the country. And at some point she rescues this wolf dog, like half dog, half wolf, from a guy who's using him as a fighting dog. And so she rescues him and they travel the rest of the way. And I haven't seen it probably since I was about 10. And it's actually on, you can get it digital download from Disney, and I kind of want to do it and watch it again, but I'm also kind of afraid that I won't. Right. I watched it a lot of times when I was a kid, and I'm kind of afraid that it won't live up to what I remember.
Right.
Knowing about it. Especially since no one else seems to know what it is. I mean, it's not like people are like, oh yeah, no, that's a great movie or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a pretty long list of those movies. So one of these episodes, I'm going to have either Eric or Lou or somebody to host for me and ask me some of these questions because I've got some.
You have answers some for them now.
Yeah, I've got some of those that I could probably pull out too. Okay, and the last question is, if you could recommend one lesser known movie that everybody should see, what would it be?
The first one that popped into my head actually is a 1952 film noir called The Narrow Margin, which among noir aficionados is actually fairly well known, but it hasn't made the jump to the general populace, you know, like something like Double Indemnity has. But it's a really taut thriller. It's all set on a train. It's there's a mob boss's widow is on the train, and these two cops are protecting her while she's traveling to the place where she's going to testify against the mob. And then the mobsters come up and like try to kill her, and there's a whole like there's a mistaken identity thing and like people pretending to be different people, and it's fairly complex plot wise. It's got like really solid it's a B movie of the time, but it's got the queen of B movie noirs, Marie Windsor, and no name people that anyone would recognize who's not into noir, but Marie Windsor is a big name in the noir community. And it's just, it does all of this on one train over about 70 minutes. And I just love that kind of really tight storytelling.
Right.
And noir is really good at it, and this is one of the best at it. So The Narrow Margin is my recommendation.
Awesome. All right, well, excellent. That's a wrap then for this episode of Flick Fights, but you can follow our chart's progress by sending a friend request to Flick Fights on Flickchart, and you can follow us over on Twitter at Flick Fights. And if you, too, would like to be a future guest or you want to send us any feedback about the show, just send us an email to flickfights@flickchart.com. I'd like to thank our guest, Jandy Hardesty, for joining us on the show. Glad you could make it, Jandy.
Sure. Glad it finally worked out.
And from all of us at Flick Fights, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.